Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the Green New Deal is a vision about how we might use the economic transformation required to address the climate crisis to advance workers' rights and well-being. In the corporate press, it's often either reduced to a story about Democratic Party fortunes or vagued out to some ideas about the Green Dream or whatever, in Nancy Pelosi's words. There is another conversation, though, where people take seriously the need and the possibility to center working people in the fight for the planet. We'll talk with Joe Uline, founding president of the Labor Network for Sustainability. Also on the show, House Democrats have introduced a bill to force the U.S. to rejoin the Paris Climate Accord. They, and the reporters whose range doesn't extend beyond them, may have been surprised to hear environmentalists respond overwhelmingly, "Oh, come on." As Food and Water Watch's Winona Halder put it, quote, "The terms of the Paris Accord aren't low-hanging fruit. They're fruit that has fallen to the ground and begun to rot," close quote. We'll talk about what's beyond Paris with Basav Sen, Climate Justice Project Director at the Institute for Policy Studies. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. As we record the show May 2nd, Venezuela's self-appointed president Juan Guaido's call for the country's military to overthrow elected president Nicolas Maduro appears to have fallen apart. This is not the preferred outcome for the Trump White House, which vigorously backed the man most Venezuelans hadn't heard of just months ago. And you might say the outcome displeases U.S. elite media in precisely equal measure. Leading up to the most recent coup attempt, research by Teddy Ostro for FAIR showed that exactly 0% of commentators in U.S. corporate media opposed regime change in Venezuela. Zero op-eds in the New York Times or Washington Post asserted Venezuelans' right to choose their leadership over Washington's. Not a single commentator on the big three Sunday morning talk shows or PBS NewsHour. You could say there was a range. The Times' Bret Stephens declared that Trump took exactly the right step in deciding that Guaido, elected to the assembly by the same process that elected Maduro, is Venezuela's constitutionally legitimate president. While a guest on the NewsHour said the point was to, quote, promote a peaceful transition in Venezuela without harming the people themselves, close quote. The same people currently subjected to onerous U.S. sanctions aimed at immiserating them into just such a peaceful transition. That guest was NewsHour's counterpoint to the one who claimed that 94% of Venezuelans, 129% of those over age 14, support U.S. intervention to overthrow the Maduro government. Well, given the openness of the U.S. punditocracy's embrace of forced regime change, the need for a linguistic fig leaf was almost quaint. But as Alan McLeod wrote for FAIR, U.S. media studiously avoided using the word coup to describe the coup they were supporting in Venezuela. Defined as the violent overthrow or alteration of an existing government by a small group, it seems uncontroversially apt. But while outlets like the Washington Post want you to support the reality, they'd prefer you use the words, quote, opposition-led, military-backed challenge, close quote. Yeah. Common Dream said it well in their introduction to Ostrow's research, quote, "It is hard to overstate just how in the tank the corporate media are for the U.S. government overthrowing another government. It's as though they never read a history book. But it's worse, because you know they have," close quote. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Republican Representative Sean Duffy likely thought he was on to a winner when he dismissed the Green New Deal as elitist, the sort of thing that sounds great if you are, quote, a rich liberal from maybe New York or California, close quote. Opposing environmental concerns with the livelihoods of working-class people has been a tried-and-true method for dividing people. Industry versus industry, the coasts versus the supposed heartland, and dividing people against themselves, as we're presumed to have to choose between having clean air to breathe or having a job. The immediate cogent pushback to Duffy's characterization from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who, along with Ed Markey, introduced the Green New Deal, is one indication that things have changed. Old fishers can't be counted on to confuse people about their shared interest in fighting climate change and advancing workers' rights. Though that doesn't mean there isn't room for confusion about what alternative visions could look like, particularly when news media, as in coverage of the Green New Deal, shortchange the role of workers in that vision. Our next guest works to fill that void. Joe Uline is founding president of the Labor Network for Sustainability. He joins us now from Tacoma Park, Maryland. Welcome to Counterspin, Joe Uline.
Thank you.
Well, even before the Green New Deal, which is not legislation but a resolution calling for decarbonization of the economy, you've been talking about the impact of climate change on workers and the role workers and labor could play in what, if we take science seriously, has to be the response. What's your starting point when you talk with people who think this isn't labor's fight, or workers whose experience suggests they'll get the short end of the stick?
Well, I start with two things. One is that climate change is the real job killer, not the answers to climate change. And we've done studies to show that, but it's, for a lot of working people, it's very obvious. For example, if you work in the public sector, which a lot of people do, the only way you can negotiate good contracts is if you have healthy state and local budgets. Those budgets will be decimated by the impact of climate change, and we're seeing that not only in New York in the aftermath of Sandy, but up and down the entire West Coast with the budget increases those states have seen to fight forest fires. As Sarah Nelson talks about, she's the president of the Flight Attendants Union, they're already losing jobs to more and more flights being grounded due to increased turbulence caused by climate change. And that list goes on. But I start there and then point out that the Green New Deal, this 14-page resolution, and I always stress that, because everybody says, well, what are the details? It's short on specifics. Yeah, it is. It's a framework. It's the best framework that we in labor have seen in a very long time for advancing workers' rights. It sets a federal jobs guarantee for people who want to go to work fighting the climate crisis. And it also provides for living wages or family supporting wages in that jobs guarantee. And it steps up to the plate on climate.
Media often speak kind of crudely about winners and losers, you know, under policy changes. But of course, it's true that societal shifts have fallout. You know, if we get Medicare for all, well, people who are now in the insurance business will need new jobs, you know, but we don't say, well, we need to keep making asbestos, you know, because those people need work. It's really more about whether you acknowledge the possibility of guaranteeing people's well-being through a transition that society needs to make.
Yeah. I mean, there are 10 industries right now, including healthcare, that are in transition with no guarantee that that transition will be just. The Green New Deal does call for just transition for all displaced workers. So again, regardless of the industry you work in, whether it's food or healthcare, transportation, energy, obviously, a lot of people are going to either lose jobs in an unjust and unfair way or transition into other jobs with income maintenance and the retention of their health and pension benefits. That's what we're fighting for.
Well, USA Today back in February ran a piece from a guy from the Cato Institute warning that, quote, this green-painted Trojan horse is filled with the biggest single government expansion the United States has seen since the 1930s, close quote. So they're actually trying to scare people with the New Deal, you know, like, remember how much you hate Social Security? You know, is this going to be the tactic to just paint it as socialism and therefore, you know, it's just bad. We can't even have a conversation.
Yeah, it will be. And it's the talking points of the American Petroleum Institute, the fossil fuel industry. And a lot of people use their talking points. So, yes. And look, they've got a lot of money. We're talking about the Koch brothers and others here. And there will be a well-funded pushback campaign that will say what you just said about, you know, this is socialism, expansion of the federal government, but also they'll say that it hurts working people. We have a little document we just prepared that sort of takes on like the six, you know, most prevalent lies that we see out there. And, you know, these are being covered extensively by the right-wing press. So we're trying to, you know, counter that with good, solid arguments.
Yeah, I have to say I resent above many things that elite media do, the way they sort of tell folks it's just not possible for everyone to have a decent life. You know, we just can't, you know. And so you might think, well, golly, we do need to overhaul our energy system. And at the same time, we have a lot of people unemployed and underemployed. Surely these things can be brought together. But then here come the very smart people to say, ah, that sounds right. But, you know, we can't do it because reasons. It's just very frustrating. But you have found that when you're able to talk around some of these undermining narratives, people, you know, rank and file, working people, understand it, right? And there are labor groups that are building these bridges.
Yeah, there are. And there are also labor groups that are trying to tear those bridges down.
Yeah.
So we're right in the middle of that scrum, if you will.
Yeah. Well, we often see politicians counterposing, as I said earlier, the environment and workers. And from politicians, it's often very fake. You know, I have to oppose regulation because I care so much about these coal miners, you know, where we don't necessarily see that concern in evidence in many other places. But still, I think can be easy to sell people on being afraid when people are already struggling, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Fear is a very powerful motivator, maybe the most powerful motivator, and they know that. I mean, you know, one thing I would point out is where have they been over the last 20 years as tens of thousands of coal miners have lost their jobs? They've not been there fighting for them. Coal miners still don't have the federal guarantee of retaining their pension and health benefits in retirement that was promised to them. And who's opposing it? All the same forces who oppose the Green New Deal. So we're fighting for that, for coal miners in retirement to retain pension and health care. And the other side, they're fighting against it. And then they still use that fear argument. It's a bit frustrating, but, you know, we're putting the materials out there that counter all of that.
Well, you were on the UN Commission on Global Warming for decades, an organizer with the AFL-CIO. I know you worked on the anti-WTO demos in Seattle. So this is a long time coming for you. Do you feel like this is it? Certainly, it's an opportunity on a scale that we haven't seen in many, many years.
Yes, I do feel like this is it. And I do feel that it is a great opportunity. And, you know, I'm disappointed when I hear labor leaders, including Rich Trumka the other day, who said, well, we're opposed to the Green New Deal. And then he rattled off some reasons that kind of indicated maybe he hasn't read that resolution. He said there's no worker interest in it. There's more worker interest in that 14-page resolution, like I said before, than anything we've seen. So I do think this is it, not only because of the absolute urgency of the climate crisis, and we see a whole new wave now of really young people rising up and striking, not going to school. That's going to grow. And this better be it. We have to win this. We have to solve the climate crisis, and we have the opportunity to do it in a way that improves the world we live in for working people and everyone. Why don't we take that?
We've been speaking with Joe Uihlein. He's founding president of the Labor Network for Sustainability. They're online at laborforsustainability.org. That's the numeral four. His piece with Jeremy Brescher, 12 Reasons Labor Should Demand a Green New Deal, can still be found on inthesetimes.org. Joe Uihlein, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
When Donald Trump declared he'd pull the country out of the Paris Accord in 2017, U.S. news media decried what was called an irresponsible abdication of American leadership. In 2018, one headline had it that a year on since Trump left the Paris Accord, the world still craves U.S. leadership. As with other issues, corporate media seem to see a bright line between Trump's stance on international climate agreements and that of Barack Obama. As with other such demarcations, that's not quite right and in some ways unhelpful. For those less interested in partisan scorekeeping than in planetary change, the touchstone is what must happen, as opposed to what any of various elites deem politically feasible, virtual code for preserving existing relationships. What's called for, our next guest says, is nothing less than to chart an entirely new path on international climate policy. Basav Sen is the Climate Justice Project Director at the Institute for Policy Studies. His article, headlined "How Trade Agreements Stand in the Way of an International Green New Deal," appears in the April 22nd Getting to Zero issue of In These Times. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Basav Sen.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, I would like to start where your recent article starts, with what is problematic about an overweening focus on Paris, with the suggestion that the U.S. rejoining that accord would represent serious action commensurate with the current climate situation. What's wrong with that?
To start with, the Paris Agreement is flawed. It's a lowest common denominator agreement, which requires nations to make only voluntary as against binding commitments to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. It states a goal of keeping the rise in temperatures within 2 degrees Celsius, with 1.5 degrees listed as an aspirational goal. And we know from the most recent science that 1.5 degrees is like an absolute upper limit of tolerable global temperature rise if we aren't to have, you know, disastrous impacts worldwide. One thing that's not recognized very widely, especially by the corporate media here in the United States, is that the United States was, in fact, instrumental in ensuring that the pledges in Paris were voluntary. It turns out it's because the Obama administration claimed that a binding agreement, which would need congressional approval, would never get approved by Republicans in Congress. And that is, in fact, true. However, one must ask, what would a real political leader do? A real political leader would do what is needed, namely a binding global agreement, and build the political case for it at home, instead of subjecting the safety of the entire planet to the domestic political compulsions and calculations of the United States, which is what ended up happening.
Well, let's talk about what science and justice require with specifically regard to the United States, because the United States does, as you say, and I think is generally understood, play an outsized role in the crisis. I wonder if you can talk about what that role is, and then what would it mean to acknowledge that role?
Right. So first of all, the United States has one of the largest global emissions of any country in the world, second highest in aggregate after China, and one of the highest in per capita terms, excluding some wealthy oil-producing countries. Also, cumulatively, the United States has by far the highest emissions of any country ever, 25% about of global emissions since 1870. And cumulative emissions matter because carbon dioxide in particular lasts in the atmosphere for up to thousands of years. And so the warming effects we are experiencing today are attributable to some extent to greenhouse gases that have been emitted since the start of the Industrial Revolution, and not just today's emissions. And given our outsized role, we obviously have an outsized responsibility to fix the problem. And one thing I emphasize in my article is that this isn't charity. Rather, it is fixing what we have broken. And so just based on that very simple principle of justice, the United States owes the world on funding for climate mitigation and climate adaptation. And just to break it down briefly for listeners, climate mitigation means transitioning the world away from our destructive fossil fuel economy to a renewable energy regenerative economy. And adaptation means making our economy and our societies more resilient to the effects of climate change that we will inevitably keep experiencing even after we go through this transition because of what I said earlier about greenhouse gases lasting in the atmosphere for a long time and therefore warming effects persisting for a long time even after we cut back on our emissions.
And you point out that part of what the U.S. responsibility or debt really to the rest of the world would be would involve helping other countries with things like aid and sharing of technology, and that one of the things that gets in the way of that are trade agreements.
Absolutely. Two elements of trade agreements in particular I want to highlight as obstacles to serious climate action worldwide. One of them is intellectual property provisions that a lot of these agreements have that could be an obstacle to the kinds of technology transfer that needs to happen. Technology transfer for, let's say, thin film solar panels or for energy storage like lithium-ion batteries, etc. And the second element is what is called investor-state dispute settlement, which is where companies can sue governments, never the other way around, in secret trade tribunals where a group of unelected so-called trade experts judge whether a country's regulations, be it for environmental protection or worker protection or community safety, interfere with the profits of private companies. And if the policies enacted by these countries are found to impact the profits of foreign private investors, then the tribunal could order the country to pay compensation to the corporation.
It's such an insult to sovereignty, is it not, on the face of it?
Absolutely. And to democracy, if you think about
yes.
it, because democratically enacted changes by democratically elected governments in the public interest can be overruled by unelected panels of so-called experts at the behest of a corporation.
Absolutely.
That's a profound end run around like just basic self-determination and democracy. And yet that is enshrined into any number of international trade agreements. And that can really interfere with climate action. For instance, if countries decide to keep it in the ground, in other words, to phase out fossil fuel extraction, then extractive companies could sue countries on that basis. And this isn't just hypothetical. It has actually happened to Canada, where a U.S. corporation called Lone Pine Resources has sued Canada over a fracking moratorium in Quebec.
Well, let me just ask you, finally, it sounds as though part of what we need to change is to change the media conversation and the public conversation from this vague notion about the U.S. taking leadership globally on climate change and make it more about the U.S. taking responsibility, and that is many magnitudes beyond a rhetorical change. That's the biggest change we could make, really.
Yes. Ultimately, this is about hubris. The notion that the United States leads the world in climate action, or even that the United States should lead the world in climate action, is based on arrogance. It's based on this idea that, of course, we are the world's greatest nation, and therefore, of course, we should lead. While ethically, as we've talked about on this show, really the question we should be asking is, how does the United States compensate the rest of the world for the damage it has historically done in terms of emitting greenhouse gases, which is a shift, a real shift in popular thinking in the U.S. that needs to happen.
We've been speaking with Basav Sen, Climate Justice Project Director at the Institute for Policy Studies. His article, How Trade Agreements Stand in the Way of an International Green New Deal, can be found on In These Times website, inthesetimes.org. Basav Sen, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
And thank you for having me on your show, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show's engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.